War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Pacific War on Film. This is your host, James Early, as always. And I've got with me, as usual, or as always, Sean McIver. Sean, how are you, sir?
Howdy.
Welcome back again, as always. And we are now on our third film of our kind of mini trilogy that we put together. It's not really a trilogy of any type, but it's three films that have a few things in common. They are all from the 1950s. They're all about naval combat, or at least naval sailors and ships and things like that. And they all have some of the greatest names in Hollywood history. So tonight's movie, as I mentioned last week, is Run Silent, Run Deep, 1958. Black and white film. And let's talk about the basics, as we always do, and then we will go into a little bit more detail about the cast and the history of the movie and everything else. So the length of Run Silent, Run Deep is 1 hour and 33 minutes. It's a very short film. Yep, that makes up for some of these really long ones we've been doing, Sean. It's kind of nice. You didn't feel like you spent half your life watching the movie. But anyway, the critical response was quite good. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a 100% positive rating. Now, I should
say, based on only 8 critics,
but still, that's really good. The audience gave it 79%, which I think is kind of low. But I guess, again, we Sean and I spoke about this last time, how the fans tend to discriminate against older movies.
Yeah, and it's black and white. So that's a knock right against it as well.
Yeah, it got an average rating of 7.3 on IMDb, which is a little bit lower than most of the ones we've been doing. The director is Robert Wise, and the film stars Clark Gable, Burt Lancaster, Brad Dexter, Jack Warden, and Don Rickles, among others. It's based on a 1955 novel of the same name, and as far as awards are concerned, it didn't get that many. In fact, it didn't actually win any. It was nominated for 1 Laurel Award for Best Cinematography for a black and white movie, but it did not win. So not a huge critical success, other than the 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. That's significant, but it's not one of these films. Some of our other films won multiple Academy Awards. This is not one of those. But it is a fun movie. It's a very suspenseful, action-packed movie. And speaking of packing, we're going to unpack it now. So Sean, tell us a little bit about Robert Wise.
Yeah, so Robert Wise was the director. He had been Orson Welles' editor on the movie Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons and a number of other movies. He became a director in the 40s of some highly regarded films, actually. The Sand Pebbles, The Day the Earth Stood Still, West Side Story, The Sound of Music, and one of his last films was Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh, I got to stop you real quick. The Sound of Music is my all-time favorite musical.
Oh, really? Well, there you go.
I did not know he was the director of that. That's amazing.
Yeah, he's the director. Yeah, and then West Side Story, of course, is a classic.
Yeah, that's a great one, too.
He made long films, though. This is a short film for Robert Wise. Most of the rest of those films are pretty long. But yeah, he was, you know, he had an editor's eye for things, and so was able to do a lot of, I mean, he had been trained as an editor, so, and actually was very innovative. He, as well as Orson Welles and their cinematographer, Robert Toll, were very innovative in coming up with ways to cut between scenes. They invented the invisible wipe, which is using a shot of the camera to go through something, to go up to something solid, and then putting another frame of film starting in something solid, so that, that's what's called an invisible wipe. So it's a seamless edit that he helped invent. So. And I just pre-ordered the director's cut of Star Trek The Motion Picture on Blu-ray. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
There is no comparison, right?
Well, yeah. I mean,
at least there wasn't at the time.
Yeah, that's true. People don't like Star Trek, the motion picture. I liked it. It's long. I have seen the director's cut on plain DVD in standard definition. It's very good because it actually cleans up a lot of the story. But I've been looking forward to the DVD for a long time. So I'm excited about that, to the Blu-ray, rather, in high definition.
All right. So how about some of these actors? Our audience has heard of at least a couple of these guys.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Clark Gable was Rhett Butler. I mean, you can't really, you can't be a fan of old films and not know Rhett Butler, you know, Clark Gable. But he did a million other films. He did 60 motion pictures from 1918 to 1960. So he won an Oscar for It Happened One Night. He was in Mutiny on the Bounty. He was in, obviously, Gone with the Wind, and in a million other films that he was in. This is one of his more prominent films. It was also one of his last films. So, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the war service of some of these actors. So Clark Gable, actually, although he was older, he was actually in his 40s, but he volunteered for the Army Air Corps during World War II. He was an officer, and he was trained as a gunner on bombers, but he mostly spent the war making recruiting films. But he did actually see combat in a B-17 flying over Germany. They were filming something and on a combat mission, and he grabbed a machine gun, a waist gun, and helped fight off German fighters. So he got in a lot of trouble because a German cannon shell actually shot through the airplane right next to his foot. And the studio and the Army were not happy about that. So yeah, the other major star of the film is Burt Lancaster. He's one of those, one of those great Hollywood stars of that post-war era, you know, along with Robert Mitchum and Charlton Heston and Gregory Peck. He's in that, and
Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart. Well, Jimmy Stewart actually has a pre and post-war star, kind of like John Wayne, but like, the ones who really came of age during the war, right immediately after the World War II. And, you know, I picture them in the 50s, right? In the 1950s, the big stars. Kirk Douglas is another example. But he actually had served in the war also as a morale officer. But he did not act before the war. He was a circus performer before World War II. And then his role in the Army actually led him into acting. So he was a major star by this point, 1958. He's actually in one of the best war movies that we will not talk about, and that's From Here to Eternity, which is about the immediate days right before the attack on Pearl Harbor. So that's one we probably should have included in a Pearl Harbor list.
That would have been good. Oh, well.
You can only watch so many movies.
Yeah, that's right.
Some of the other actors, 50 of them. Jack Warden is in it. He is really one of those great character actors who's in a million things. He actually had served in the Navy before the war, and during the war, at the very first 1941, he served in the Merchant Marine, and then he quit and joined the Army and missed the D-Day invasion. He was in the 101st Airborne, 501st Infantry, Parachute Infantry Regiment. He missed the jump because he had an accident in training and was
Shattered his leg, I was reading.
Shattered somewhere. His leg and was not able to participate at all in combat at all. So. But he actually kind of served as an informal advisor on this film, as did another actor, legendary insult comic, Don Rickles, who is Johnny Carson's favorite guest of all time on the Carson Show. Rickles had served in the Navy during the war, and he is making his film debut. And it's actually a serious part for him. So he's not caustically insulting to everyone. And then one other actor is a major part in this film, Brad Dexter. He's always overlooked on a lot of films. Brad Dexter, if you remember, played Harry Luck in the film The Magnificent Seven. He's the not famous person that was in the Magnificent Seven group. There's like five famous people and then one young actor, Horst Buchholz, who's a German playing a Mexican peasant. And he kind of stands out. And then Brad Dexter, who's really good in the film, he played the guy that was looking for the gold in the Mexican village, Harry Luck. But you know, he plays kind of a heel in this film, and he mostly played tough guys, right, in gangster movies. So he was personal friends with Frank Sinatra and did a bunch of television. So he's just a he's one of those guys you've seen in a million things, but people just don't often remember him. And he served in the Army Air Force during World War II. So,
all right. Well, these guys get 100% rating for serving in the military during the war.
Yeah, quite a few of them did. They didn't skip out.
Yeah. No John Wayne's there. No.
I mean, give John Wayne a pass because he tried and they just wouldn't let him.
Right. All right. So let's get into the plot.
Yeah.
So it starts. Go ahead.
Yeah. One more thing. Well, we do want to talk about the source material.
Okay. Yeah.
It's actually an interesting story. Run Silent, Run Deep. It was based on a very popular novel by an officer, a serving officer in the U.S. Navy at the time, 1955, Edward Beach Jr. Beach had served as the executive officer of the submarine USS Tirante, which was commanded by George Street. And this officer, George Street, was awarded the Medal of Honor for a daring attack on a Japanese harbor in 1945, very similar to this sort of story that we're talking about here. He also commanded a submarine in the last couple of months of the war, had a successful patrol in the very final months of the war. After the war, he served as a staff officer in the Navy with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and an alternated, kind of the peacetime role of alternating staff roles and shipboard roles and submarine commander. And he started writing right after, even as while he was serving. So he actually published a nonfiction book right after the war. After publishing this fiction book, which did very well, he gained fame by commanding the nuclear submarine Triton, which completed the first submerged circumnavigation of the globe ever. So he circled. They actually followed Magellan's path, his believed path around the world in a submerged nuclear submarine, never surfacing once.
That's fascinating. That's a really neat little backstory there.
Yeah, and I believe he did retire as an admiral. So,
well, that's always nice. It's good work if you can get it, right?
Exactly.
All right.
Actually, no, I'm sorry. He retired as a captain. He did a not captain. Retire as
okay, a, close. Well, that's almost.
Good. Long career, so.
Yeah. All right. So, introduction. In the Bungo Straits, which run through the Japanese home islands, a U.S. submarine commanded by Commander P.J. Richardson, that is Clark Gable's character, is searching for targets when a Japanese destroyer known as the Akikaze suddenly appears. And the Akikaze destroys Richardson's submarine, but he and some of the crew survive. After that, Richardson is assigned to desk duty at Pearl Harbor, and he's determined to get revenge on the destroyer captain, who he nicknames Bungo Pete, who has sunk three other U.S. submarines in the Bungo Straits besides his own. In an effort to prepare for this, he constantly war games an encounter with Bungo Pete with his friend, Yeoman First Class Kraut Mueller. Kraut is the nickname. I didn't catch his actual first name. I don't know if they tell it. But anyway, that's Jack Warden's character, a young Jack Warden. it's funny. Mueller says, well, you've sunk Bungo Pete several, I don't know, dozens of times. And he says, yeah, but always on a desk or something like that. So Richardson is determined to get revenge. He wants to get back and sink Bungo Pete. And he persuades the Navy board to give him a new submarine command with the provision that his executive officer, that's his second in command, be someone who has just returned from active sea patrol.
So a couple of notes here. The USS, the submarine that was actually used in the film, it was used in all of the parts. It was the USS Redfish, which had seen extensive combat during the war, including sinking the Japanese carrier Unruh. So it was actually a war veteran. It had been used in a lot of TV and film. It had most recently been used to play the Nautilus in Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, speaking of Kirk Douglas. So they had mocked up a superstructure on it to play the Nautilus. So it was an actual war veteran of the right class that they would have been using a Kato or a Trench class ship or a Balao. But this in particular was a Balao class submarine. So I'm interested, though, like how would, if they were in the Japanese home islands, how would they have been rescued?
That's a good question. I have no idea. That was supposedly in 1942. As well. So
I don't think there's any less likely. Yeah, there's certainly not any other, maybe another American submarine picked him up or something.
I could see that happening in 1944, maybe 45, probably, but 42. Yeah, that's kind of, I don't know.
That's pushing it a little bit.
Yeah, that's a stretch.
Home waters. So the Arakaze was a real Japanese destroyer, but it had actually been sunk a bit before the events of this film. So, yeah. So a little bit of license. And just to give people an idea of the Bungo Straits, where that actually is, it's actually a very important stretch of water leading into the Japanese inner waters. So if you picture if you're watching the Olympics right now as they're going on and you're looking at a map of Japan, picture the big island, which is Honshu, which is the main island where Tokyo and most of the cities are. And then there's Hokkaido on the far north. That's a large island. But then south of Honshu are two islands, Kyushu and Shikoku. Those two islands sort of kind of sandwich right up along the bottom part of Honshu Island. And so in there is called the inner waters. And so Kyushu and Shikoku make a kind of a T intersection that's the Straits of Bungo. That goes into the inner water. So those are protected waters, and they're very important for inner island transportation. Food, effectively. Food and things, you know, because remember, Japan is entirely dependent on either what it can grow or what it can bring from the raw materials that can be brought from the different parts of the country and of the, you know, from Korea and from China. And at this point, by 1945, they're entirely dependent upon rice that's grown in Honshu and other food that's, you know, and meat, beef and stuff that's up in Hokkaido, bringing that down to the islands that are the two islands, Kyushu and Shikoku. So the inner waters were critical. And really it was a point when we began mining those inner waters with submarines and with carrier aircraft and long range bombers, mining the inner waters was when Japan was basically going to be starved to death. So getting into the inner waters is very critical. So that's the strategic importance of this strait. Now, I don't think we were trying to force that in 1942. Nothing that I've read has kind of indicated that, but it makes for a good story.
No, they should have made the years 44 and 45.
Yeah.
You mentioned that in your notes. That would have made it a lot more historically accurate. Right. 42 and 43, no.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, and the torpedo problem. They still had the torpedo problem, but like you mentioned, the film seems to indicate that had been solved.
Right, right. Yeah, so definitely in 42, that would have been a problem. In 44, we really solved it in 44.
Basically. Right. Yeah, we talked about that in our battle series, how the torpedoes were just garbage for until like late 43, 44.
Yeah, they were terrible. So, yeah, I mean, they really were, you know, they know that. They believe that the Midway torpedo bombers did make some hits and they just didn't explode.
Right.
So,
and as we'll see as we go through the plot, the torpedoes in this film are terrific. They're extremely accurate. And
there's a very, very good John Wayne movie called Operation Pacific that's specifically about the issue with the torpedoes. And it's kind of a dramatization of the multiple processes and people that tried to solve this problem. It kind of condenses them into the John Wayne character, but it's about a submarine crew that, you know, is sick and tired, you know, is nearly killed because their torpedoes just don't work. And they've tried to sink things. So they're trying to fix this. And there's a great scene where and this really happened. Apparently they hold a torpedo up from a crane and drop it onto the concrete outside of a airplane hangar and nothing happens. So they're trying to get the timer to go off. It's an interesting scene. It's a film that has Ward Bond in it too. So I know you'll like it because you like Ward Bond on almost as much as I do.
Yeah. I like John Wayne. I like Ward Bond. Yeah. I'll check it out for sure. All right. So let's move on in the plot. So we left Commander Richardson plotting his revenge on Bungo Pete. In the meantime, another submarine called the Nurka arrives in port. Its captain has been wounded, and its executive officer, who is Lieutenant Jim Bledsoe, that's Burt Lancaster's character. Bledsoe assumes, as do the ship's crew, that he will be made the captain of the Nurka. It's a reasonable assumption. The captain gets wounded. He's got to be taken out. He can't serve anymore, so why not just raise up the XO to the number one position? But his superior officer, a captain, comes on and tells him that he will not become the captain. He will remain the XO of the Nurka. Instead, command of the Nurka will be given to Commander Richardson. Bledsoe is highly disappointed, In fact, angry, we could even say. He goes to see Richardson at his home, and he asks him to find another XO. He doesn't think he can serve with him, given the circumstances. Richardson refuses, saying he specifically requested both the Nurka and Bledsoe. He also, that is, Bledsoe, resents Richardson and the Navy leadership for denying him command of the Nurka, which he believes should have been his. It's an interest. It's a fun. I don't know if it's fun, but it's a memorable scene because Bledsoe goes to see now Captain Richardson, captain of the sub, that is, and Richardson is up in a tree. He's climbed a tree and he's trimming branches while he's up in the tree, and they're having this conversation while the captain is in the tree. It's really kind of funny. But yeah. So what else? What do you got for this one? James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
No, I mean, it's just the Nurka was a real ship, but it was not completed in time for the war. So some of the things they're picking out of thin air to do, but that's fine. Yeah, I mean, that could happen. If you were a senior boat captain, you could pull rank. And, you know, if you had the right type of political pull with you know, especially given the fact that, you know, Nimitz was a submarine commander. He was a subman. And so he gave a lot of latitude and a lot of independence to the submarine captains to range far and wide without specific orders, just to go, you know, kill the enemy, just, you know, destroy the enemy. And so, you know, it's entirely possible that a experienced commander like Richardson could pull rank, get someone who was ready to, you know, take someone's ship who was about to be promoted to commander of the ship and block his promotion and make him his XO. It does certainly happen. The interesting thing is, this is a plot point from Star Trek: The Motion Picture. If you remember the plot of Star Trek: The Motion Picture, Captain Admiral Kirk does that to the new captain of the USS Enterprise.
who was the new captain? I forgot.
Oh, Stephen Collins, Decker, Captain Decker.
Okay, yeah, I haven't seen that. In so
they were
long.
Refitting the Enterprise. Kirk was. Why are we talking about Star Trek in a World War II podcast? But
I don't know. It just keeps coming up. I don't know. All right.
Yeah, so there you go. Robert Wise reuses plots. There you go.
Yeah, I want to point out here a problem that we've seen in all three of these C movies from the 50s that we've been seeing, and that is that Clark Gable was just too old for this role.
Yes. You know,
Clark Gable was like 56, 57, and he's playing, I think he's a full commander, so at least he's not a lieutenant commander like Cagney and Bogey were, right? But, but I mean, he's the age of a senior admiral, and Burt Lancaster was 44.
Yeah.
So, and he's playing a lieutenant, which probably would have been somebody who was 25 or 30. So,
well, to be fair, at least there's no female romantic leads in this that is 30 years younger than the star. So, we experienced that with Sergeant York.
That's true. Yeah. But, you know, like, for example, Admiral Nimitz in 1941 was 56. Okay. Halsey was like 59 or something. So,
right.
So anyway, I don't know. I know they were going for these. They wanted to get these Hollywood legends, and all of them were, I guess, on the twilight of their career. I know Cagney, you said Cagney had a long career after the 1950s, but not so much with Bogey and Clark Gable. So
right.
It's just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And we saw Henry Fonda as a 40-something-year-old lieutenant junior grade. I don't know. It's a minor thing, but it's a little bit unsettling. But, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to put somebody who's 30 years old or 25 in that role, then they wouldn't draw it. All the people, you know, yeah, you don't want to get somebody new.
Yeah, it works. I think it works.
It works okay. All right, so the mission begins. The Nurka sets sail for its destination, which is Area 7. This is an area that's very dangerous. It makes the crew nervous. There's a superstition about it. Richardson tells the crew their mission, and a part of their orders from on high is to avoid the Bungo Straits. Remember that, listener. They're supposed to avoid the Bungo Straits. But Richardson single-mindedly trains the crew of the boat, planning to return to the Bungo Straits and sink Bungo Pete in spite of the Navy's orders not to do so. So he's got his own agenda, and he doesn't really care what the orders are. He is obsessed with going back and getting his revenge on Bungo Pete. So we can compare him to the other two captains. Let's see, Captain Queeg was just crazy. Captain, what was the one in Jimmy Cagney's character. What was the name of the
captain?
Morton. Yeah. He was just a jerk. He was a martinet. And this captain is not, he's neither one of those, but he's just obsessed. He's got a completely fixated on getting his revenge, and he doesn't care. He's going to do anything he can to get there. He begins to rigorously drill the crew on a rapid bow shot, which is firing at the bow. I'm sorry, not bow, firing at the bow of an approaching ship, which is considered by most sailors to be an act of desperation due to a vessel's extremely narrow approach. Normally, shoot at an enemy ship, you want to shoot it at it sideways. It goes back to the old, well, that never mind, that's different. But the idea is you want to get as much target as you can. So you want to shoot at the side of a ship, not the bow, which is the front, because there's very little to hit. But he makes them practice. He wants them to get it done quickly. He wants it done in a very short amount of time, and they have to do it over and over and over again, and the crew gets totally sick of it. Right, Sean?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's relentless, but it is an interesting tactic.
Yeah, the crew begins to talk about, oh, we're just out here to drill all the time. We're winning the drilling awards and all that. They're itching for combat, and they don't get it. For example, on the way, the Nurka spots a Japanese ship, but Richardson refuses to attack it. And now the crew really starts to get a little bit put out, because that's a submarine's job, is to sneak up and blow enemy ships out of the water. But he just goes right by it. And so Bledsoe, the XO, and much of the crew are disappointed about this, and they begin to speculate about the purpose of the drills. The officers criticize Richardson for focusing only on drills but failing to attack, but Bledsoe stops them. Now, that's a good XO. We've seen that in some of our other movies, too. The XO is supposed to have the captain's back, so to speak, and to try to support the captain and not let the other officers criticize him and all that. During a drill, after Richardson orders a dive, the crew discover that one man was left on deck. So here's the ship going down, and here's this poor guy. Wait, I'm and they stop. Richardson halts the dive. The man is saved. And it turns out he was dumping garbage, and that actually is very important to the plot later on. Richardson reprimands
for not knowing that the man
deck. He says, it's your responsibility. So again, we have another movie where the captain, the XO, don't get along, but for different reasons, and then some of the other ones. I wonder how common that was, Sean. I wonder if anybody did a study, like what percent of captains and XOs didn't get along? Because
we're seems to be the common theme. But again, this is a common theme from the Mutiny on the Bounty. It's one of those ageless stories that keep recurring. So, you know, you're pointing back to a story that you know works, which is the Bounty story, right?
Yeah, I guess it'd be a boring story if they just got along perfectly, yeah, right? Yeah,
and this also has a lot of Moby Dick in it, right? Mm-hmm. Richardson's obsessed with Bungo Pete. That's right. His obsession. So,
and actually, to be fair, these two get along better than the two did in the other movies, certainly in the Kane Mutiny and Mr. Roberts, definitely. But it's an interesting dynamic. Okay, so the Nurka is going on. It continues on towards the Bungo Straits, and it encounters two more Japanese ships, a destroyer and a tanker. And this time, Richardson wants to attack, but he orders the crew to bypass the destroyer and attack the tanker. They destroy the tanker, and then Richardson orders them to attack the destroyer with a bow shot. So here's this bow shot, specifically wanting to do it. He's basically practicing for later. The destroyer is itself destroyed, and Richardson praises the crew. And the crew, for their part, earns a new respect for Richardson. They now see the purpose of the drills. But they also begin to suspect that Richardson is avoiding legitimate targets in order to enter the Bungo Straits undetected, in direct violation of his mission orders. And they also believe that he is saving torpedoes for Bungo Pete. And then finally, Lieutenant Bledsoe confronts Richardson, and he confirms this. Richardson just says, yes, I am. He admits he's been planning this since his last boat was sunk by Bungo Pete. Bledsoe demands that the captain inform the crew that they are going to the Bungo Straits, and he does. Then the officers urge Bledsoe to assume command of the boat, but he refuses. Here's that mutiny theme again. You know, the captain's crazy. In this case, not the captain's deliberately violating his orders. So clearly the XO has to assume command, but he's not going to do it. Mueller hears, remember that's Jack Warden's character, and he's a friend of the captain, and he tells Richardson. So that makes for some awkward moments, doesn't it, Sean?
Yeah, I think the film does a really, really good job, especially for 1958, of really showing the tight quarters and the claustrophobia of being in a submarine in general, but like in the bridge, the conning tower of a submarine during combat. I think that is, it does a really good job of that. And you know, you really didn't get that again in a really, really strong way until Das Boot, which is the German film from the 1980s, which is magnificent in showing this claustrophobia of being in the submarine. But yeah, I think that this film does a really good job in a very stark way. And the black and white helps of really, really making it real. And then the other thing is that the realistic, there's a lot of realism in how they're talking and the terms they're using and range and bearing calculation, you know, using the analog computers to make shooting solutions, that sort of thing. So I think that this scene, these couple of scenes where they're this tension and Richardson also showing that he's got a good plan and drilling the men has worked because he shoots at the bow and he shoots at the bow of the tanker because the tanker's not going to move and he wants to see that it's going to work. Right.
Right. And you know, he justifies what he's doing. He says to Bledsoe, he said, well, a captain has flexibility in his orders. If he feels like the situation warrants a change in orders, then he's allowed to essentially disobey the orders and do what the situation demands. And so he's using that very broadly. he believes that the situation demands that he go and sink Bungo Pete so that Bungo Pete doesn't keep sinking more American ships. But again, that's a bit of a stretch, but at least he has some kind of justification for it.
Right. And by asking for an executive officer that A, has just come off of a patrol, but B, is about to be a captain, means that he doesn't have to train someone new to the role, right? Mm-hmm. And so what he's really doing is he's giving Burt Lancaster's character a graduate course in being a captain.
Right. You were talking about some of the details. I noticed, I was just watching it earlier this afternoon, and I saw a lot of attention to detail too. For example, during the combat sequences, you see the men's shirts are like sweaty as all get out. Like they're soaked in sweat. And that's a nice touch.
Yeah.
They're showing how hot it got in those subs. They didn't have to do that. You know, they could have just had them put on fresh shirts and acted out, but they don't. And they show how the men would not always wear full uniform. There's guys running around in t-shirts and there's guys running around in like Don Rickles' character wears a cutoff shirt. The sleeves are cut off. So a lot of nice attention to detail that I appreciated. Yeah.
Well, and then the other thing is that what makes Richardson different than Wharton and Queeg is that he does care about the men. I mean, he does care about his crew. You know, he stops a dive to rescue a man who was left on deck.
Right.
That's important to remember about this character. He is obsessed, but he's not to the point of single-mindedness of abandoning everything for this quest. And so that's the difference of Richardson versus a Captain Ahab. From Moby Dick.
Right. I think
Ahab would have left the man behind. Yeah.
Of the three captains that we've seen in these movies, I think I'd most want to serve under Richardson. Definitely. All right. Shall we go out to the Bungo Straits now?
Yes, let's go.
It's a fast-moving movie, and it's a fast-moving commentary. So here we go. They've reached the Straits. The Nurka comes upon a large convoy, which includes the Akikaze. So there he is. Richardson has found his target. But, of course, it's not that simple. Soon after blowing up a cargo ship and then engaging Bungo Pete, they're attacked by aircraft that had been alerted to their presence and were waiting in ambush. So the Nurka is forced to dive, and they barely survive depth charges. The Japanese surface ships just keep dropping depth charge after depth charge and just over and over and over. Three of the crew are killed, and Richardson suffers a concussion. He falls and hits his head really hard. And he's never really the same after that. The submarine also narrowly dodges what the crew mistakenly believes is one of their own torpedoes, doubling back on them. And that's a legitimate thing for them to think, because that is one of the many problems that American torpedoes had early in the war. Sometimes they would literally turn around and go back, and there was at least one instance of a sub being sunk by its own torpedo, which is awful. So they think that one of their torpedoes has doubled back on them. And we'll leave it there for the time being. Now, they decide to try to trick the Japanese, however. So they send up through the torpedo tube, some of the empty ones. They send up blankets. They send up equipment. And they even send up the bodies of the three men that have died. So all this debris and bodies go to the surface, and the Japanese see those, and the Japanese become convinced that the submarine, the Nerka, has been sunk. Richardson passes out, and when he recovers, he tells Bledsoe he wants to return to the Straits. Again, he's not given up on his obsession. And Bledsoe doesn't want to do this. He thinks it's suicide, and he uses Richardson's injury as an excuse to assume command and set course for Pearl Harbor. So he's going to get out of there and bug out. At least that's the plan for now. So here we actually do have, I wouldn't call it a mutiny necessarily. In this case, there's no doubt that the captain was
continuing to
man. He keeps blacking out from time to time. But again, the captain is not real happy about this, but he doesn't really try to resist it that much. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I put a note in here, something I was noticing earlier. Clark Gable is very convincing as in the role of a man who's just suffered a concussion. He's constantly kind of slipping and kind of putting his head down and stumbling around. And as a matter of fact, he wasn't necessarily acting. He was ill during the filming. We see his head violently shaking in several scenes. And according to one source, at least, it's believed that his shaking was caused by his chronic alcoholism and smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. Although there were also rumors that he had Parkinson's disease. He also had severe back problems, and he would die only 2 years after Run Silent, Run Deep was released. So he really wasn't having to act that hard to portray a sick man, was he, Sean? James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Yeah, and Don Rickles said that in his Don Rickles autobiography in 2007, he did say that he remembered sometimes Gable would just, Gable liked to adhere to a strict 9-to-5 approach to the workday. And so he would stop working during the film, you know, at 5 o'clock and would walk off the set. But Lancaster, late in his life, he had nothing but praise and admiration. He said that Gable was a consummate professional. So there's all kinds of different stories about Gable and, you know, what was acting, what was not, you know. Yeah, Gable had an alcohol problem, but he never, from what I've ever read, he never let alcoholism interfere with his work. But yeah, he was not a healthy person. He was not a healthy man by 1958. So
yeah,
and you know, and then he filmed The Misfits, his last film, 2 years later with Marilyn Monroe, and it was both of their last films. And he was very, very ill at that time. He actually died before it was released. So
yeah, all right, that's. It's sad, but, you know.
But, I mean, he turns into a very good performance here. Yes. I think he is very effective in the role.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's very good. Everybody is, I think. Okay, so moving on. They're listening to Tokyo Rose proclaiming the sinking of their boat. But several crewmen are amazed to hear Tokyo Rose actually naming by name several of the crew members, including Captain Richardson and Lieutenant Bledsoe and Krautmuller and others. And they're wondering, how does she know our names? How does she know who is on this ship? Bledsoe then realizes that the Japanese have analyzed their floating trash. So all this trash, we talked about earlier that a man was throwing trash over the side, and we see that another time later on. So the Japanese have been not reading their mail, but reading their trash. And so Bledsoe decides he's going to turn that to his advantage. Since the Japanese believe that the Nerka has been sunk, Bledsoe changes his mind. Instead of going back to Pearl Harbor, he decides we will go to the Bungo Straits, and we're going to fight the destroyer Akikaze, and because they don't even know we exist anymore. They think we don't exist. And so he uses that to his advantage. Then he encounters the Akikaze, and the Nerka sinks it. But then they're... to their great surprise, the Nerka is attacked by a mystery torpedo once again. And then by this time, Richardson has kind of recovered a little bit. He's come out of his bed. He's come out to the bridge, and he figured us out that the Akikaze was not working alone to sink U.S. submarines. Instead, there was a Japanese submarine that was working in concert with it. It would hide behind the Akikaze. So on Richardson's recommendation, Bledsoe orders the Nerka into a dive just seconds before a Japanese torpedo races by. And then, so the Japanese sub and the American sub, they both go totally silent. They even turn off their engines. They're just floating there. They lose contact with each other. They're very close. They're just floating, but neither knows where the other is. Then the Nerka finally surfaces and attacks a ship in the Japanese convoy in an effort to force the Japanese submarine to the surface. In other words, they realize that they've got to get the Japanese sub to the surface if they're going to wipe it out. So the best way to do that is to attack some of the other ships in the convoy. That will force the Japanese sub to go to the surface, and the plan works, and the Japanese submarine is sunk. And then we get to the very end, which is very abrupt. Richardson collapses on the bridge. He dies, and he's buried at sea. And that's it. Sean, what do you think about that last part?
Yeah, that last scene is very
first
tense.
First of all, I'm sorry, let me continue. It's very exciting. It's very suspenseful, and, you know, especially when everybody's quiet and nobody's talking, and Don Rickles coughs, and everybody looks at him like, oh, that was, what'd you do that for? You know, so anyway, go ahead.
No, it is. I agree. It's a very tense, exciting scene, and it makes sense what they're describing, and there was a lot of combat between submarines during the war. So did you talk any in your battle series about Tokyo Rose, or have you talked about Tokyo Rose before?
I don't think I did. I was going to do a special episode, but I didn't get to that. So
yeah,
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So Tokyo Rose,
it's a group of people actually.
Yeah. Tokyo Rose was actually a group of people, but the most famous ones was Eva Chiguri Dakino, but it was a Japanese propaganda broadcast. And there was a series of them that were English speakers, and they broadcast propaganda and American music to American soldiers in the South Pacific, in the West Pacific, or East Pacific, all through from Tokyo, but over high broadcast, high frequency radio. And it's kind of a trope that you'll see in war movies of the Tokyo Rose. And she talked like this: "Hey, American troops, I'm so sorry that you're losing the war and that your girlfriend back home," you know, and then they'll play, you know, the Andrews Sisters or something like that music. And most American troops kind of rolled their eyes at her and used it, you know, enjoyed listening to the radio, but didn't believe a word that she said. So but this was a common practice. Both Japanese did it, and the Germans had several propaganda broadcasters, Lord Ha Ha and Axis Sally. Eva Chiguri Dakino was a Japanese American disc jockey who was in Tokyo at the time of the war began, and she was co-opted by the Japanese into doing these broadcasts. She actually was arrested after the war and charged with treason, and was convicted and put in jail for a number of years before she was given a pardon by Gerald Ford. So, and there's a lot of controversy about her, because there was investigations that showed that some witnesses lied about her during their testimony, that she was acting under duress. So that was why President Ford gave her a pardon. But yeah, it's a general trope that you'll see in a lot of war movies, especially more recent ones. But war movies we use Axis Sally or Tokyo Rose to kind of, you know, show ironic in movies. It's used to show ironic things like that. And this is a very good use of Tokyo Rose of reporting real information about the troops and about the soldiers and the sailors in the battlefield and it sometimes baffled them how they got that information. And this is a good way of showing that, you know, you analyze this floating trash that the submarines had left behind. So,
right. And she's in several of the movies we're discussing in this series. I think she might've been in the Thin Red Line. Do you remember? I can't remember.
I can't remember either,
but, also Flags of Our Fathers, I think maybe, I don't know. We'll find out. We'll keep track of her as we go along.
So there was a study done in the 1960s that said 90% of them recognized it as propaganda, less than 10% felt demoralized, and 84% said it was good entertainment.
That's funny.
And that a lot of them considered them on their side. The GIs thought of her on their side. So,
yeah, I mean, they would make outlandish claims like, "We sank 5 of your battleships in the last battle." Yeah, right.
Yeah, she was a civilian who was prosecuted by the military without a trial and imprisoned, charged and imprisoned. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was a lot of people that actually lobbied for a long time. And then finally she got a trial and was convicted. But again, they found that there was perjury going on. So, you know, who knows?
All right. Yeah. Well, she certainly, the movie hinges around that scene where she talks about the, you know, Kraut has been killed and Captain Richardson is dead and all that.
Yeah.
So she plays a major role in this movie for sure.
Yeah. She's mentioned in the song, There's Nothing Like a Dame in from South Pacific. And we'll actually hear her in The Bridge on the River Kwai. We like watch that film.
All right. Well, let's see. So this movie, there none of the characters are historical.
Nope.
Although maybe some of them are based on real people, but maybe give some thoughts about the cast. Final thoughts about the cast and the acting and all that.
I think it's a very good cast. I mean, it's interesting to see Don Rickles because he's, you know, I'm used to hearing him, you know, calling people names and
yeah, he doesn't insult a single person.
He doesn't insult anybody.
Jack Warden does some insulting, doesn't
he? Yeah, I love Jack Warden. Jack Warden's one of my favorite, one of those character actors that I just love. So, no, it's a good film, and it's casting is very well, although kind of everybody's too old for the part, but definitely.
Yeah, it seemed like all the crew hands are middle-aged men. There's only a couple of young guys.
Yeah. But no, I think it's a good film, and I think the cast is pretty good. So I don't have any objection to anybody. There's no women at all to be seen in this film. So
except for the wife of Captain Richardson, that's right. For like 5 minutes. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one of those guy movies. But yeah. I think it's not a perfect film. The ending to me is a little bit too abrupt. I think they could have maybe done a little bit more about Richardson's death and all that. It just seems like he's okay 1 minute, and then the next thing they're tossing him over the side. You know, I don't know. That was my thought. It just struck me as abrupt. I don't know what you think about that. Anyway, all right. So, but I think as we've already discussed, it gives a pretty good portrayal of what it was like to be on a submarine and the challenges that those guys faced. So we've now come to the moment that you've all been waiting for. Maybe we may even have listeners that just fast forward to this, Sean. I don't know.
I doubt it.
We're going to rate the film from 1 to 5 stars. So, Sean, how would you rate this?
I'll give it a 3.25. I mean, I don't love the film. I actually had never, I think I'd seen it years and decades ago, but I didn't remember it at all. So but I think it's a good film. It's a fine film. It's not my favorite of the films that we watch, but I'll give it 3.5. We'll go 3.5.
All right. Well, I think I'm just overall a little bit more generous, but I don't know. I'm going to give it a 4.0. Okay.
That's fair.
I liked it a lot. I like the fact that it's not, there's no annoying romantic subplots. There's, I mean, there's no fat. All the fat has been cut out. Maybe too much.
It's a very lean film.
Yes.
But it's not bleak. Now, if we were going to watch Das Boot, I'll give that one 5 stars, but it's one of the most bleak films that's ever been made.
Yeah, I bet it is. I haven't seen that one yet, but it's on my list.
Oh, yeah. Now, if you want to see a much different toned film that's a lot more like Mr. Roberts, but it's about submarines, go watch Operation Petticoat, which has Cary Grant and Operation Petticoat was, Cary Grant and Tony Curtis. And it's about a Navy submarine that's escaping from the Philippines, and they paint it, and it's the paint is oxidized in it, and they've got a submarine load of nurses, and the paint oxidizes and turns the submarine pink. So it's comedy. It's about escaping from the imminent disaster of the Philippines but it's actually a very funny movie. You should watch that one.
All right. Well, that wraps up that sounds like fun. That wraps up our discussion of Run Silent, Run Deep. Next time, we're going to go back onto the land. So our naval miniseries is over with, and we're going to be talking about a film that's about the Battle of Saipan, but it's more than that. It talks about the role of code talkers from the Navajo Nation who served in the Marine Corps during World War II and made a huge difference. And this, of course, is the 2002 film Wind Talkers. So we'll see you then.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lem, and Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for key battles of American history. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabres, Anna Concepcion Castro, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works. And lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Scott Hendricks, Hoosier Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.